This episode of Therapy Insiders is sponsored by WebPT, makers of the awesome and super popular EMR software. Recently, I spoke with WebPT COO and co-founder Heidi Janangam, and I asked her, what really separates WebPT from other EMR companies?
Actually, I think we're the only EMR company that does not charge you a service fee for live calls. So we have, live bodies here right in Arizona that are taking our customers' calls when they have a problem or answering emails when they send us a support ticket and they have a question about something.
WebPT, high-tech, awesome EMR, but with a human component. They're always ready to talk and listen. Check them out at www.webpt.com or give them a call for a free demo, 866-221-1870. Let them know Therapy Insider sent you. Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. Dr. Gene Shirakabrad here with Dr. Ersin Religioso. Ers, how you doing?
I'm well. How about you, Gene?
Not too bad. We're kind of recovering from the previous couple podcasts. So we've been getting a bunch out pretty quickly, and it's been fun and exciting. We're still kind of in the buzz from our previous announcement of us starting a media company, UpDoc Media. And so Ersin and I, we talked, and Joe couldn't join us today. He's out and about. So Ersin and I were talking. We're like, you know what? We're making this huge announcement that we're starting, you know, a media company. Who can we get as a guest to really, really go off with a bang? And Ersin had an idea. So I'll let you, Ersin, introduce our big guest.
Well, when I talk to students about Cook, they all think I'm talking about Gray Cook, but I'm actually talking about Chad Cook. So I had never heard of Gray Cook until just a couple years ago, but I've been following Dr. Chad Cook's research for a while, and I cite it in my seminars, and I cite it in a lot of my blog posts. So if you don't know Chad Cook, you should read up on his research, and I'll let Chad do the rest of the introductions.
So you're going to let him introduce himself?
Tell us about where you work and where you started out. And okay, Chad used to work at Duke, and then he went to Walsh, right? Some school in the middle of Ohio, right? And then he happens to work with one of my brightest students ever, Dr. Megan Burrowbridge. Is it still Burrowbridge?
Yeah. No, it's Donaldson now.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot. I'd have to look that up on Facebook. And then your email is Duke again, right? Are you back
with
Duke?
I've been with Duke about a year. Okay. So I'm back. I'm like a boomerang. And it's been a really great experience. I have a research role and doing the stuff I love, and still corresponding with my Walsh colleagues. But things are going very, very well, and I appreciate you guys having me on.
Yeah, thanks, sir. Thanks for coming on. So some of the research, or I think one of the things that you wrote that really resonated with me was just an editorial for the AOMPT journal. And it was basically about why most research is not validated. It's not, it may not be clinically relevant unless it's validated. Can you go over that?
Yeah.
For our listeners?
Sure. I was a former editor-in-chief of JMMT. Presently, by the way, senior associate editor for British Journal of Sports Medicine, which is another great journal who likes to really push the buttons of evidence-based practice. I wrote a lot of stuff in my previous editorials as a way to try to educate the readership on to use some caution when you read research and when you see a paper published. And there were so many different facets to it, how the data were collected, who the researchers were, and how that influenced the outcomes of the study. Just the outcomes measures and what they were used and how they were used. I mean, all of these pieces really matter and can lead to completely opposite results into relatively well-done studies.
I remember, it's been 4 or 5 years ago now. I remember, Chad, you did a presentation at the APTA conference in Maryland. I don't know if you remember that, when it was in Baltimore. I think you presented on the cervical spine. And at that point, I remember watching and listening, and it was one of the first kind of integrations that I got, because, you know, people have talked about research, but 5 years ago, I don't think, 5 or 6 years ago, research, it was coming along, evidence-based practice was being pushed, not as hard as it is now, I don't think. But watching your presentation, it was an integration of, here's the research, here's the techniques, here's how you combine the two. Do you see that as lacking? Because I feel like a lot of people are so for evidence-based practice, which I know is good. But do you see a lack of relevance to the clinic? Do you think that's still something that's evolving? Or is it something that I'm just completely missing?
No, I think you're spot on. I'm a believer that the clinical reasoning piece is really the structure that builds the decision-making processes and PTs. And it's up to a good physical therapist to make the good evidence fit within that clinical reasoning structure. I don't think an article published here and there is going to be the thing that really influences the way a person addresses a patient. It can influence it in a positive way if it's used correctly. I think the mistake is made when people assume that a single publication or something of that nature is going to trump clinical reasoning in general. Nothing trumps good, honest clinical reasoning.
And that's such a huge, huge point. And we have a lot of DPT student listeners, and I think they're so impressionable, and they want to really push the profession forward. And I think they're more passionate than I've ever seen, but they're also impressionable. And then when you see a lot of big names pushing evidence-based practice without grounding it in clinical practice and making it relevant to daily practice, that's a hard thing for them to swallow. And I feel like so many people use, like you said, a single article out of context or defensively, or, ha, see, I told you, that it really doesn't do us service as a profession moving forward.
Fully agree. And, you know, we're in a profession where charisma influences the way that clinicians practice dramatically. And let's go back maybe 4 or 5 years ago, when there was this fervent passion about clinical prediction rules, which have a place in the decision-making processes, but we were willing to adopt any clinical prediction rule that was published in JOSPT or some other journal and adopt it directly into clinical practice and trump any decision-making processes that we've built through years and years of study as a profession. And it was a huge mistake. And we've come full circle now, and you actually see people reasoning with these appropriately. In fact, I actually have an editorial in a Spanish journal that just came out today. And speaking of Twitter, I saw it on Twitter. And it's called Appropriate Clinical Reasoning with Clinical Prediction Rules. And it basically talks about the fact that, you know, we need to always move slowly and how we adopt these things. We need to make sure that this fits what we know to be true through appropriate reasoning processes. But this fits on a number of areas where we, you know, as a profession, we pick up on the passions a little too quickly, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of finding a nice middle ground, which I think, not to blow Urson's horn too much here, because he's my partner and I don't want his head getting too big, even though we had a good discussion about head size earlier today. That's why I like Urson's eclectic approach, because I feel like, Urson, you do a really good job of using the relevant data, but you make it applicable to clinical practice. And I'm guessing that wasn't something you did overnight.
No, I mean, it took me a long time. And I was one of those ones who was caught up in the clinical prediction rules, but also I just tried to, I think I realized probably after a year or so that they were more predictive of who would have a better outcome, but you wouldn't necessarily need to use the specific interventions that they recommended. And I think that's something also you came to a conclusion pretty quickly too, correct, Chad? About this, they identified more of a population that would be more receptive to certain interventions, or any interventions, actually.
Yeah, you're correct. It's, you know, there was an assumption they were prescriptive, meaning that they are tied to a treatment intervention, but in reality, they were prognostic. And I do remember reading something of yours, whether it was a blog or something of that nature, and I remember you talking about that, about one of the papers we had written in PTJ, where we found one of the clinical prediction rules to be something we called a universal predictor. At every outcome measure that we used within that sample, it was actually the strongest predictor of a good outcome, regardless of the intervention. So it is, it's very prognostic, and it's because many of the early models that were created statistically, by no fault of the researchers, they just didn't know, they didn't do this research the right way. So a lot of the stuff that was published in the past wasn't really done right.
Yeah, when I wrote that, I actually got some blowback, I believe from one of the author's colleagues of the original lumbar CPR that said that that was the only one that was validated, and it was actually validated with different interventions. And when the appropriate intervention wasn't used, then that the group that didn't get manipulation did not have as good of outcomes. And you know, I read that, but I mean, it was quite a different study than the original. I'm not necessarily sure if it validated the original lumbar CPR, or if it just showed that this particular set of patients responded better to manipulation rather than to exercise.
There's a lot of debate about that. And, you know, it's difficult because the validation study was done very well, but there are three subsequent papers that have come out from different sets of authors using different interventions, and they find very different things. So it's, you know, it just, to me, What it tells me is if somebody meets that criteria, if they're an individual with acute low back pain, they don't have referred pain below the knee, then they are probably going to be a manipulation candidate. You know, our study we just published in Physiotherapy Canada, it was a retrospective study, certainly not the same strength as the validation study, but we found that basically if they met that particular clinical prediction role, it didn't matter if you used manipulation or non-thrust manipulation, that the outcomes were going to be the same. So my feeling is they're manual therapy candidates.
Right. Manual therapy as an input. Whatever. Yes.
So manual therapy has, I feel like when I was going through school, that was the big thing, is research on manipulations and, you know, PTs really doing it more and it becoming more mainstream. Obviously, exercise at that point was somewhat more established, at least certain exercises. And now I feel like, and you can definitely correct me if I'm wrong, Chad, or if there's something else in research that we don't know about, but I feel like the big thing, the big push now is dry needling. I feel like that's the pro dry needling camp is trying to get as much research as possible. What have you seen so far in the literature coming through, or pro or con, and kind of where we stand for dry needling, and what do you think about it?
Yes, you know, that's a great question. It's one of the, it's, you know, like I said, we jump on themes, I think, within physical therapy, and dry needling is popular now. Clinical prediction rules were popular 3-4 years ago. You know, kinesio tape was popular. You know, it's, and some of these things have an effect. I do know that dry needling has an effect. From what I've seen as an editor and having read the papers that have actually studied dry needling, it does have a treatment effect, meaning it does make a difference versus another form of intervention. The effect is small, and the effect measures so far have been short-term primarily. So there needs to be more to investigate this. It, you know, if somebody asked me, do you think it has promise? I'd say, yeah, as a measure in conjunction with other interventions, I think it has its place. Is it so significant that it's going to change practice? You know, I question that. But I think it's just another of many tools that we have. You know, you mentioned exercise. I my personal belief, and I'm a manual therapist, and I publish a lot in manual therapy. I have a manual therapy textbook, but there's nothing that has the same effect as exercise. Exercise, and we don't even know enough about it yet to to give the appropriate parameters. But if there's ever anything that has promise as a profession, if we continue to explore that, I think we're going to be doing ourselves a lot of good.
So exercise, let's break that down a little bit, because I feel like kind of almost it gets almost relegated to, you know, the stepchild, because it's so comfortable and it's just there that we don't have to worry about it. You know, it already has a parent that's being dealt with, but it really isn't, right? Because it's we talk about movement, we talk about what is really our bread and butter. And with all the Twitter conversations and all the other conversations that I see, I don't feel like exercise comes up enough anymore, because it's kind of assumed. So when talking about exercises, I mean, what are some exercise criterias or FMS screens or different categories that you think that exercise should really be focused on or done or evolved into?
So when I think of exercise, first of all, it's multidimensional, right? There's so many different parameters to it, and it's so ill-defined in the literature. It's ill-defined in all the clinical practice guidelines. But I think the area that we as a profession could probably make the most strides in really putting our stamp of this is ours is probably resistance exercise. And just building up people's tolerance to external demands, their endurance, their strength. All of these things are really the bread and butter of what a physical therapist does. So, if I had to identify what area that has probably the largest possible treatment effect in comparison to all the different interventions we do as physical therapists, it would probably be resistance exercise.
Yeah, I just actually talked about this today. I had a little poll in my blog that basically asked, how often do you exercise or strengthen the body part that is in pain? And I haven't actually even looked at the results yet. And I would tend to believe that I think most PTs tend to strengthen the body part that's in pain, say a shoulder impingement, immediately. But I tend to try to modulate or get rid of the pain first. And then once that threat is mitigated, then I kind of start with strengthening, even if it's needed. Because often, since pain alters motor control, I find that whatever the scapular dyskinesis or kind of aberrant movement patterns tend to just reset themselves once the pain has been modulated. But I do agree with the fact that many PTs don't push their patients enough. And, you know, that's been identified, especially the elderly population, which could definitely use some resistance training.
Let me ask both of you this. Is the lack of us pushing resistance because we are afraid of injuring patients, or because of our lack of true knowledge of resistance training?
That's a great question. You know, it's interesting that the most common undergraduate degree that people have when they come to PT school is exercise science, but it's amazingly deficient, the knowledge is, when, as an educator, when you teach these individuals, they just don't have the capacity to think appropriately as far as determining exercise demand. So I do think part of it is knowledge. The other part of it is, you know, I don't know. In the clinic, I just see that people get stuck in a mundane pattern of not being very novel in the way they exercise their patients. And I think part of that is there just isn't that spark there to do it. Erson, what do you think?
I definitely noticed that you're right. I mean, when I taught at three different PT schools in Buffalo, and I noticed that the students who were best at prescribing strengthening exercise were those that actually worked out themselves. And if they didn't if you were someone who worked out, or maybe you're maybe an athlete who just followed your coach all the time, but you couldn't design your own program, I mean, I just found a lot of students kind of went to like a Kendall textbook to figure out what to do for every shoulder condition and every knee condition. And I mean, that was my experience with it, that the students who just could design their own program for themselves were better at designing a patient's program. So I do think that it's, like you said, a lack of knowledge. But I think it's not only for exercise. I mean, I would say many clinicians kind of fall into a rut for any intervention. You know, they just have like these cookbooks for shoulders and cookbooks for knees.
No pun intended, but they probably do have a bunch of cookbooks.
Yeah.
Those are...
but not the cookbook, which yeah. our fellowship used, actually, at Amen. So.
Get a cookbook. Yeah, I've actually been thinking about this myself, because I think if we really combine our ability to see faulty movement patterns, pick out faulty movement patterns, I think we're really good at it, and I think we're really good at picking them out, and I think sometimes we're so good, but we don't even know what we're picking out. Like, we can tell that something's not right, but we might not necessarily process exactly what's not right, which is okay. At least we know. But if we can integrate, like Kirsten said, if you worked out yourself, or if you have a base knowledge of exercise physiology or human physiology, which we should have a little bit more than that. But I know one of the biggest complaints I hear from students a lot is a lacking exercise dosage class, or just an exercise class, period. And I can attest to that, because I remember going through school, I was like, man, these exercises suck, because they're kind of like passive exercises, like you said, Chad, in the beginning. So, I mean, we've been on a big kick of kind of revamping the foundation of PT schools based on business. But maybe we should really think about that for exercise as well.
I've heard that for years, basically, as a clinical educator and also an educator academically, the students always complain that there is a lack of exercise. And it's just one of those things that I would always tell them, that's kind of what your internships are for. And if there's a, you know, it's also been identified, there's a lack of quality affiliations out there as well. So it's like you got to pick and choose, or I tell students to, you know, hang out with strength coaches, hang out with people other than physical therapists. And it's one of the things that Gray Cook and guys like Charlie Weingroff say, who are strength coaches. They say the strength coaches first and kind of PT second. And I think we have a lot to learn from individuals like that outside of our profession.
You know, it's interesting. This morning, Rob Butler was in my office, and he is an FMS guy and does research. And he mentioned that he feels that the first year PT student should have to complete a CSCS and basically study to be a personal trainer, because there's so much that is learned in that process. And, you know, the other part of it is the motivation side. And I am a believer, too, that you have to do the exercise yourself. You have to know what it feels like. You know, if I'm good, I am the believer that a brewmaster, the best brewmaster, is probably the one that drinks a lot of beer and knows the good taste of beer. And
see, now I really like your analogies. That's a good analogy. But now I want a beer, damn it. Sorry, I got you off the rails.
No, no worries.
About beer soon.
No, I agree with you guys on that. I think, you know, as professionals that I taught, we had a faculty member at Walsh who went on a sabbatical, and I took the clinical exercise course, and I said, I'm going to change this from ground up. Basically, what it's going to be is each week there will be 8 modules in which the students will have to participate in the different types of exercises that they will be assigning their patients. And it, you know, it went from low to high level. It was great. They got perspective. They also learned a trillion different exercises. So they when they went out to their clinic, they had a mindset of just a bolus of exercises that they could potentially pull from.
I think that's perfect. And I know there's sites like MedBridge and things like that, but I feel like there's still a disconnect between students being comfortable and prescribing it and seeing it in person. You know, it's knowing an exercise is one thing, and a lack of it still sucks coming through school. But to really integrate it into clinical practice, and it's kind of like you guys are saying, it's if we kind of combine a strength coach with a PT, that's a force to reckon with in doing them properly, doing them in the proper positions and proper times of healing, which is huge. Funny you said about the exercise science. I was a exercise science major, bio minor, and some other minors. But I still have my notebook and all my books from ex-phys and human phys that I look through once in a while. And it's incredibly relevant information.
Yep.
But speaking of relevant information, I know you see all kinds of probably cool literature come through your way. So to kind of close us out, is there something that really interesting that you're working on now or have seen coming through?
I have a research position, so I'm lucky. I have a number of different things. We've just completed some work on surgical outcomes and looking at predictors for people who benefit from surgery. And I talked a little bit about that at CSM just in earlier this year, and have a couple papers coming out in that. I've been working with Jason Rotohiro, Josh Cleland, Paul Mitkin, and Mike Raymond, and we're publishing a series of risk stratification papers. And we're the idea behind the papers is we're looking at these really large patient databases of people that received conventional physical therapy. And we've identified individuals that are exceptional responders. In other words, they got better significantly, marked improvements with hardly any visits. And then these individuals that go forever in the clinic, they have multiple visits and there aren't any changes. And we've identified the characteristics of those individuals with the premise that as therapists, maybe these aren't the people we should treat. Very similar to the concepts of the start back criteria. We've done that for the shoulder, knee, neck, low back, and we just completed the hip. And it's interesting that it's this seems to be the same predictors regardless of the body part region. So
can you share those, any of those predictors, or even give us a little teaser, or do we have to wait for that to come out?
No, because actually a couple of the publications have come out already. So
okay, because I think I've seen recently, I don't know if it's a knee or shoulder one.
Yeah, I think it was probably, I know the low back one's out and the cervical one is coming out and probably within a month in manual therapy. But, you know, something we've seen as clinicians forever that has been the same, I've been a PT for 25 years and this was a problem back then, it's still a problem. It's insurance type is the biggest predictor.
Yeah, I read that.
Yeah, if they're on litigation, if they're on work comp, and you know, it's always been kind of bantered around as a possibility and that sort of thing. But in a conventional practice that isn't just work comp related, these people stick out like sore thumbs. These are the folks that do very poorly with multiple visits. You see no change in functional status, and it seems to be regardless of body part region, with the exception of the hip.
That's interesting. Now, I have a follow-up question to that. What do you think of the study that Gwen Jahl's group did that basically showed the most evidence-based kind of team approach had no better results than just go do whatever you would do as a patient for the chronic whiplash group? Because I feel, and it was also, they said it was independent of whether or not they had litigation. What do you feel about that population? Why do you think that is?
I think the chronic whiplash population, I think the selected populations of low back, I truly, honestly think they are outliers and they're outside of what we would consider candidates with our clinical practice guidelines. I think they are, I'm studying chronic pain management right now at McGill University, and which is kind of the origin of chronic pain study. And I've learned so much about the non-physical parameters associated with an injury aren't going to respond in conventional ways. And so I think it probably has to do with that. Actually presented with Gwen Jahl in February and talked to her a little bit about some of the work that she's done and some of the things she's identified. And I think she feels probably that might be one of the reasons too. I don't mean to speak for her, but I think that's my impression. That's what I think it is.
Yeah, I felt like it was blame. And I know that there was someone who said that there was a physio in Toronto or somewhere in Ontario that was studying this, but he felt that it was because they have something to blame, you know. And it's interesting that you mentioned the hip, because in my seminars, when I talk about that research, I always say that when someone falls down the stairs, they never blame the stairs that their hip is broken, but you know, they just kind of recover. But it's like when they're in an accident, whether or not, you know, even if they hit a tree or something, it always seems like it's the car's fault, or maybe someone ran them off the road, or you know, I've had patients who don't even get better after the lawsuit is over, because you think that's it too, and then they still have this kind of persistent pain state, and it is a conundrum. But I mean, when that research came out, I did feel better about my outcomes for that population.
Oh, I know. And, you know, to me, when studies like that come out, one of the best things about it is that it helps explain reasons for a lack of success in certain areas, I think. And, You know, I once had a mentor tell me, you know, what makes you so arrogant that you think you can get everybody better? You know, that the patients are playing a role in this recovery process too. And it, truly, the state of the patient, it matters so dramatically. And, you know, we look at something called a readiness scale that you can assess. It's too long for conventional practice, but it's actually perfect for research because you can identify those patients who are truly ready to change behaviorally and to recover. And when they're not going to. They really have to be ready to do that.
I think that's one of the hardest things in practice to learn early on is that you will not help everybody, especially in the manual therapy world. I remember being a student and you know, learning a bunch of stuff in the courses that, you know, I learned from Jim Meadows and, you know, going through my CIs and just you know, you get a few quick responders, like, you know, Gerson calls them, and, you know, oh, my God, I can help everybody. And then you get that patient that leaves, and they're like, yeah, I guess I feel a little better. Or the patient that leaves, oh, man, I'm not feeling well at all. And you just start to go, like, really question yourself. Am I really as good as I thought? And you really start to go down that thought process and hopefully come to that realization, like you said, Chad, sooner than later that, you know, people are people. You can't help everyone always, and they spend 2 hours, 3 hours with you out of hundreds of hours in a week. There's a lot of variables that we can't control. It's just we do our best with what we have, like evidence and clinical practice and everything that we mentioned in this podcast, which I think has been a ton and has been great information. So I want to finish out with a question for you, which is if you could give advice to our students or just new grads practicing in terms of research and clinical practice, what would it be?
That's great. You know, I hear, especially talking with you guys, I think one of the best things they can do is first be humble, but be skeptical. And then secondly, get your information from multiple sources and talk to knowledgeable individuals and get their viewpoints on things. Because I think a lot of really, really smart people are going to have divergent opinions, and that's okay. Once they understand why they have those opinions, it's going to help them assimilate that information well.
I think that's great advice.
That is some great advice. Gene and I both talked about how we started off our first years as you know, the best thing since sliced bread, and you rapidly learn that you're not, especially when you've gone through manual therapy training.
That's for sure.
My mindset when I left school was I wanted to be the best physical therapist in the world. I kid you not. That was my mindset. And then a few years later, you know, I had that moment. I was like, what the hell is the best physical therapist in the world? It's like I wanted to be something. And then I had this introspective moment. I was like, what does that even mean? What is the best physical therapist? And so then I started going down different paths of really figuring out what I wanted to do and how I wanted to practice and go beyond practice. And I hope everyone does that. So that's your hashtag Project PT. Really have an introspective moment of what you want to accomplish with your career and where you want to be in the next 3-5 years. If it's clinical practice, if it's starting a business, if it's buying a lot of Chad's books, any of the stuff. Really think about it and let us know what that is.
Or you can watch his courses on MedBridge.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, it was great, man. Thanks a lot for joining us. If people want to find you, where can they find you?
Well, they can. I am on Twitter, so I'm Chad Cook PT, and I tweet about one thing every month. But I promise it'll be more than that. You can email me.
It's a good one, though. It's 140 characters of gold.
I'm going to start tweeting you like every day, Chad, until you're forced to reply because your email is going to be just spammed with my tweets.
You can email me, too, if you need to get a hold of me about something, chad.cook@duke.edu. And then I'm all over MedBridge, so I do love that company. I think it's a great way to get – it's an efficient way to get information.
There you go. Urs, any closing thoughts?
No. You know, I think a critical appraisal of the research is very important, and I like your focus on the clinician portion of the pillars. You know, I think I hear people say they need to throw out the pillars of evidence all the time, three pillars of evidence, and, you know, the clinic clinical experience or reasoning is not as important as the evidence, and I do not understand those people at all.
No, I don't either.
You know, it's like those people who always say, I hear a lot of new grads, and there's a couple guys on Twitter who are basically, you know, citing the research that showed that experience does not affect outcomes. And I definitely agree with that. You know, there's a ton of experienced clinicians out there, if you're going by years, that have very poor outcomes because they just do the same thing with every patient. But I always say, so in 15 years, are you just going to concede to all the new grads? Like, you're going to be one of those guys who's stuck in a rut? I mean, like, the only people who cite that research are people who are new. they're noobs, right?
Gotta have the research for the noobs. Well, speaking of research, obviously, if you had to send our listeners to a good hub for research, you said MedBridge is a good place for exercises and things like that. What about research if they want to find research?
You know, I'm a believer in PubMed. I'm a believer in identifying the articles that you want and you need yourself, and looking at that, it's a little extra time, it's a bit of an extra burden, but I am an unfiltered research connoisseur.
I just pictured you with a monocle and a pipe, just flipping through.
Mm-hmm. With a glass of scotch. That's me.
There you go, glass. Yep. Can't believe I forgot the scotch. Damn it. All right, so Chad, thank you again for joining us. This has been awesome. Really appreciate your knowledge and information.
Thank you guys for having me.
And again, you can check us out, therapyinsiders.com. If you haven't heard, again, we kind of mentioned in the beginning, Urson, Joe, and I are starting a media company called UpDoc Media. So all that's going to be going live pretty soon. If you haven't followed us on Twitter at UpDoc Media, check that out as well. You're going to be throwing out a lot of tweets soon and tweeting Chad every single day. So again, leave us a review if you can on iTunes. That'd be really great. It helps us out, stay up on the charts, and helps people hear the podcast and our information. I think we're up to like 6 listeners now, so that's great. We're growing steadily. And one more big announcement. I know we've said that as we launch the media company, UpDoc Media, there's a few more pieces to the puzzle that we'll kind of disclose as we go. So I'd like to announce one more of those pieces. And by pieces, I mean, if you can picture a puzzle, it's like one of those big, big, giant puzzles. And then, you know, there's always a piece that's a lot bigger than the other ones. And this is one of those gigantic pieces of that puzzle. And I'm very excited and honored and privileged to announce that Dr. Ben Fung will be joining UpDoc Media to do a lot of the blogging and the vlogging and to help with creating, moderating, and publishing the content. So Ben, welcome, thank you, and for whatever reason you decided to join us, God bless you.
Thank you, Gene. I got to tell you, I am just as honored and privileged. This is going to be a very exciting, very high energy time with just all the pieces, like you said, coming together. And it's going to be very interesting to see the various perspectives and how UpDoc Media, it's going to change, in my opinion. We're going to be able to change the way that people in their lives, people in their businesses, and people in their walks, life, career, school, what have you, we're going to change perspectives, you know, and that's what's exciting.
So for those of you wondering how it all is going to look, because we all have a clinical mindset, but that's not everything. So Ben is obviously has an MBA. He also has a doctor of physical therapy degree. But we're interested in providing and creating content that is beyond just healthcare. That's business, that's various interests, that's something that will help you bring value to whatever you do, and that's in a lot of respects, from business to running to healthcare to just general interest things. So we're not really limiting ourselves to one thing, but we're also going to be incredibly discerning in what we want to bring. Hence, content you need to know, brought to you with clinical precision. So a lot more coming from Ben, Ben, you want to tease him with anything before we close this off?
Sure. So we're thinking that my blog and my blog content is going to start this way. It's going to be business feng shui, doing business the feng way. We'll be teaching you various things on how you can leverage strong business principles with relevant case studies, with actionables that we're going to give you, bit by bit, precise, and efficient.
Well, I'm excited to see it. I want to see that now. So let's get working on it. And so again, keep track of it. UpDoc Media, follow us on Twitter. A lot more content coming. And the website will be launching soon. And when it does, you will hear it first. So Ben, welcome aboard. And thanks for being the giant puzzle piece.
Thanks for having me. It's going to be great.